I might be criticized for what I'm going to say, and criticized harshly.
You could see that as time were going on, they're losing weight. I mean, have you ever managed a team for this long where they're subject to those conditions?
By time, culture, heritage, relations, there is an inbuilt bias towards what Israel says. But all the atrocities, all the crimes, all the blood is not seen inside Israel. We come as eyewitness, and eyewitnesses are not welcomed. And when they are not welcomed, then they become targets. You said, I said. And therefore, I'm objective. But that's not journalism. What we are hearing, you can be like a microphone or a loudspeaker rather than a journalist.
Can you walk us through what happens on that day at Al Jazeera head office when, you know, colleagues wake up or they may be following at night and they hear that their colleagues have only been killed?
Yes, Israel is trying to shut up all the messengers. I haven't seen anything like that. Sometimes words cannot describe it. Sometimes pictures cannot describe it, because there is something that's completely wrong. We don't lie, and that lasts. While people who lie, their lie don't live for long.
Salah, there's one thing. Can you just move your chair so that you're in the center of the picture, the frame?
Move the chair to this direction?
Yeah, there we go. Now you're in the center of the frame. Okay, perfect.
Okay.
Yeah. It's very loud, bro.
Sorry.
Okay, we'll start in a few seconds. Okay, 1, 2, 3, action. Hi, good day. Welcome to another episode of Unapologetic. Today, I'm joined by the head of news for Al Jazeera English, Salah Najm. Salah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hello.
It's a pleasure having you with us, Salah. I know it's been very challenging getting you. You're a very busy person, and we've had some technical difficulties, so we really appreciate your time. Salah has been the head of news for Al Jazeera English for about 15 years. He's also been essential in setting up the first Al Jazeera Arabic. He's also set up the Arabic channel news at NBC, at BBC Arabic, at Al Arabiya. So you're a veteran journalist, well-known, and most recently in the aftermath of Israel killing Anas al-Sharif and his colleagues, you've been making media appearances. And we're here today, Salah, as you know, to discuss how Israel has been clamping down on the media, how Al Jazeera, specifically including Al Jazeera, and how Al Jazeera has worked its way around that, how you've managed to continue your consistent coverage of Gaza, and what your sort of how Al Jazeera has distinguished itself says about Western media and says about the other mainstream channels. So, Salah, just first off, just what's your reaction to the introduction I just gave? What's your thoughts on everything I just said?
A few things. First, veteran journalists, I worked for some time. I'm going to complete more than 45 years in this profession very soon, working in several news organizations, as you said. And everyone has got its character and the way of dealing with crises like this. But the principles are the same. And this is the most important thing. We shouldn't forget the principles of journalism that we should all follow, regardless to the method or the way or the final goal, what it will be. Yes, that's what I can say.
Okay. We all know that by the time this goes out, which will be in a week's time, it will be a few weeks since Israel killed Anas al-Sharif and his colleagues. But, you know, there's been many journalists that Israel have killed in Gaza in the last 22 months. Many estimates put that at 270. There's been at least 10 Al Jazeera journalists who have been killed. Before we get into this war on journalism that Israel is waging, despite that, we've probably also seen, while there's an unprecedented attack on journalism, this has been the most broadcast war in recent memory, right? Because of local journalists, because of local people with their cell phones. Can Israel shut down the message?
It's trying, certainly, and trying hard, and trying in a bloody way. In the past 2 years, we have seen that with Al Jazeera journalists and with Palestinian journalists. And actually about the reporting from inside Israel, which we shouldn't forget. All the reporting inside Israel is under very severe and heavy censorship by the military censor. So what are you getting from inside Israel is only now the government and military statement. But what is happening really? How do people feel? What are the status of the army soldiers, recruits, economic situations, social security, all of that is unknown. And and from the other directions. What is being allowed to be watched in Israel is also censored, but that's more of self-censorship. So audience in Israel, as much as we understand, they don't see the scenes that we are getting from Gaza. Gaza for them is the Israeli soldier who's going in a glorified way on top of a tank and achieve holy mission for Israel. But all the atrocities, all the crimes, all the blood is not seen inside Israel. And that's forming the Israeli public opinion as well. Yes, Israel is trying to shut up all the messengers and try to cover what's happening in its 2 years war in Gaza.
Okay, in a short while, we're going to go back to sort of talk about how this has been ongoing. Obviously, they've been accelerating it in the last 2 years as they've accelerated their genocide. But we're just going to go back and sort of talk about since 2005, since the settlers left Gaza, or didn't leave, but were made to leave, and Israel increased their security. But before that, I mean, when you were making your media rounds in the aftermath of the killing of the journalists, I think this one clip of yours resonated with audience all over, and we'll play it in the actual recording. We'll play it for our audiences, but where you say that,
as no doubt you're aware, an organization like ours at Sky News has not been able to report from Gaza directly unless embedded with an IDF regiment and accompanied. How important is it for access for international organizations like Sky News?
Look, you can hire Palestinian journalists in Gaza. You can vet their work. You can vet their background, as we did, okay? And they can report for you directly from Gaza.
I mean, we've seen this retort all over. We've seen Piers Morgan keeps on saying it. I mean, it's obviously right for him to push for international journalists to go into Gaza. But why is it that you think there's been such a reluctance by all these major news organizations, unlike Al Jazeera, to do that, to hire local Palestinian journalists and you know, show the world what's happening?
To start with, I wouldn't assume there is bad intention from all of them. Some of the reasons are because they are unfamiliar with the region we are in. Don't forget, Al Jazeera is broadcasting from the Middle East and from Qatar. And we have something like 50 nationalities, and among them, good number of people from the Middle East who reported for a long time from Palestine, from Gaza, from the West Bank, and from other Arab countries. So we are familiar with the ground. More contacts we have with journalists from Gaza, from West Bank, and from Israel. So if I'm thinking about recruiting a new staff for us in Gaza, I have to ask around, and I'll find someone who knows someone because they studied together in a university, or they are from the same country, or they work together somewhere. And by doing that effort, you'll discover a talent, and all what you need to do is to coach them about your mission and vision and values and the way you are working, and then you have a correspondent. Not only that, but you have to have your own checks and balances inside the channel to guarantee that. I'm sorry for that.
No problem, it's fine.
To guarantee that what you are reporting, or he is reporting, is really accurate, and don't depend on only one source. So that's one of the reasons. They're not familiar, they don't know context, but also there is embedded, I think, acceptance to the Israeli side of the news. Israel is perceived all the time as the only democracy in the Middle East. It's almost a Western country. So there is something you can feel with the Western news organizations in common. So whatever was in the past being mentioned by Israel, it was almost taken for granted until you start probing and try to understand. But that will require more knowledge also about what's happening really and all sides of the story. And one last thing is, I think it's fear. If you are mistaken in covering the Arab-Israeli conflict and you put a little piece of wrong information about Israel, you'll be accused automatically of pro-Hamas, pro-PLO, anti-Israel, anti-Semitic, and that's character assassination that's being followed for decades and years and years against journalists in different parts of the world. So that's some of the reasons. Other reasons could be because, and that's important as well, it's ethical. If I hire a journalist in Gaza, I have to guarantee that there is insurance on him, on his life, on his health, on his family, and not all organizations can afford that financially, let's say, or logistically.
Okay, I see what you're saying about the difficulty and logistics, but the Western media, CNN, BBC, Sky, almost all outlets have come under fire a lot from protesters. People have protested outside. The New York Times regularly has protests in the last 2 years outside of their headquarters. The same with the BBC. In fact, the British police have banned protesting outside of the BBC because that's how often the protests were happening. So clearly, the audience seems quite upset, and there's been lots of analysts and critics saying that, especially in the aftermath of Israel's beginning its assault on Gaza, but even now, that there's been lots of bias, lots of Israeli voices, not enough pushing back against, you know, the spokesmen of Israeli people. Just what's your comments on just on your analysis on how do you think those other channels coverage has been?
As I explained, I mean, there are several reasons for that. A lot of the coverage is seen as being biased and severely biased, and that's why it's at the beginning of the war it didn't attract all these demonstrations you are talking about or protests or whatever, because people didn't know really what's going on in Gaza. Now the picture, when it started to come out by channels like Al Jazeera and some others who are working on the ground, the contrast became very clear and very obvious between what we are reporting picture-wise, live coverage, even numbers of casualties, and the role of international organizations in verifying what we are saying. Then there was one side which was not mentioning the whole truth, and that's the channels you are mentioning. A lot of them also is satisfied by just saying we are conveying what we are hearing. But that's not journalism. What we are hearing, you can be like a microphone or a loudspeaker rather than a journalist. You hear something, you start questioning it and try to reach a conclusion or understanding whether it's a fact or not. And I think that effort was not done, and all these organizations you mentioned were satisfied by asking Salah, for example, what is your comment about the assassination of your correspondent Anas Sharif in Gaza by Israelis? And they'll say, we deplore that. And then you go and ask Israelis and they'll tell you he's Hamas. And they put this and that together without really trying to dive in and understand what is the truth and what's happened.
Do you think there's an element of maybe racism where they don't sort of trust and value the voices of Palestinian journalists or of you know, Arabs who are appearing on their screen as analysts or as commentators or people from the region? And how do you think that plays into the coverage?
Look, I hate to go into the argument of racism, but I would say there are cultural biases inbuilt from education, from the history, from the heritage, practices, exercises, bad experiences. So I don't think it's racism. Maybe a lot of them didn't deal thoroughly with Palestinian or Arab journalists. Maybe they are not sure about the values that they're representing. Most of the channels in Europe and North America are holding themselves as the custodians of the real principles of journalism. And I'll give you one example. For example, Ofcom in the UK is having objectivity as a condition for broadcast. And of course, we in Al Jazeera are trying to be objective, aspiring to be objective, because complete objectivity, we understand it's almost impossible. What most of the channels you are mentioning in the West are interpreting objectivity by is, you said, I said, and therefore I'm objective. But in fact, that's flattening the journalistic effort completely. Objectivity, as it's really interpreted, is in the process of examining an issue. You have to examine all the aspects, all the points of views, all the angles, and then you reach conclusion. And when you reach it, you have the supporting argument for that. So I can come out and say, Ashfaq is wrong because of 1, 2, 3, 4. I researched that. But if I say Salah says Ashfaq is wrong, Ashfaq says I'm right, that's not journalists, journalism. And that's why they think that they are holding objectivity and balance and fairness and whatever, while their interpretation of these principles were diluted by time and by all the factors I mentioned before. And they expect the other journalists from third world in general to be like that. Give me the balance. So ask that and this and tell me they said that, instead of asking, is that true what you are saying? Do you have the documents that support that? What are the eyewitnesses that will enhance your tale? They don't do that. And that's why they are hesitant to get a Palestinian journalist, because maybe he's not going to be fair or objective, or he will follow the Palestinian bias only, which is a false argument, I believe.
Okay, you mentioned earlier on how proximity sort of impacts your coverage. And obviously, Al Jazeera is in the region. It's had reporters in Gaza, both foreign correspondents located there, foreign correspondents they fly in, and local journalists for a long time. Just disclaimer, I know this also because I've worked with you at Al Jazeera. And I mean, our audience will come to know that you are the head of Al Jazeera English, and Al Jazeera Arabic has its own journalists. Obviously, you're all part of the same network. And Anas Al-Sharif and his colleagues, and most of the journalists who have been killed in Gaza who report for Al Jazeera, have actually been correspondents for Al Jazeera Arabic. So we'll talk about all of that later. But you mentioned the process of building a presence in Gaza. When you go back to 2008 with the operation that Israel did there, and I mean, back then, probably for the first 4, 5, 6 years of these massive wars that Israel were waging on Gaza after it withdrew the settlements, there were mainly foreign correspondents reporting. And then you saw later on, you know, Al Jazeera and others started hiring more local journalists. Explain to us how that ecosystem developed, because it did develop under your tutelage. You're privy to it. So explain to us what the internal dynamics was there, because I think it's useful for the audience who aren't usually part of the journalistic process and the news gathering process.
But you mean internal dynamics in the channels?
That's true, but also just in terms of building a news gathering apparatus in Gaza and how it changed.
I'll tell you something, which in 2008, I was the head of news in the BBC Arabic service. And we had something like 2 correspondents in Gaza covering the events that's happening there. And we had the ability to send also non-Arab correspondents to Gaza, which we did at that time. And we got the news from the minute by minute from there, because also we have the transmission ability from there. I think that was eroded by time, a bit by bit, as places like Gaza specifically became a little bit dangerous. And I think Israel worked on that very thoroughly in the past 20 years, if we say. For example, and I want to talk about Al Jazeera only, Al Jazeera offices in Gaza were bombed, I think, 2 or 3 times deliberately, and other news organizations as well, Associated Press, as far as I think or believe, and Agence France Press once. So intimidating and threatening and destroying the abilities of journalists in Gaza was targeted and eroded and worked on very, very thoroughly and systematically by Israel over the years. Some organizations who are determined to get the story out and who have the knowledge and ability to do that continued, like Al Jazeera, while others let things erode gradually and therefore depends on the other side point of view more and more, and therefore the bias came. It happened like deliberately from the side of Israel and organically from the side of media organizations.
I mean, can you walk us through just what that pressure has been like, both from Israel? I mean, the sort of the pressure when they bomb your offices or kill your journalists or warn you. And then obviously from the censorship, I'm sure there's also diplomatic channels that they sometimes try to exercise. From what you can say, what's it been like experiencing that pressure and how you've managed to sort of resist it?
The pressure was never through diplomatic channels. We don't communicate with diplomatic channels. We are media organizations. We don't have anything with diplomacy. So that's not the case here. The pressures were the pressures on access, getting in and get out of the location, movement, if you can move safely or not, safety of people and whether they're getting threats or not. The pressures was also in being in an organization or covering the news in an objective way, while you are always being accused by being pro that or pro this or a mouthpiece of that or this, and trying to target individuals as well and try to dig into their past and he'll dust or dirt on them, rightly or falsely, because 99% of the time it's falsely. So that happens. It's campaign. It's an ongoing conflict for so many years, and its tools are studied and being used by the parties in it. We come as eyewitness, and eyewitnesses are not welcomed. And when they are not welcomed, then they become targets and they are pressured. That's what happened usually.
Last week I was speaking to Mohammed Shahada, who's from Gaza and he's now living in Copenhagen. You may know him. He's a political analyst and commentator, probably a president of Al Jazeera quite often. And he was speaking about how, as the blockade or the siege on Gaza was enforced, people started looking for an income. And one of the ways they could make income, local citizens of Gaza, was by turning to journalism, turning to a camera. And I mean, how is that? How have you seen that from your perspective? Because I'm guessing in those first, initial period up to about 2015, you relied heavily on foreign correspondents. And it's partly that it's also just a part of like the ecosystem. People are now recording on their phones. A lot of more people are media savvy around the world than they were 15 years ago. But how has that been? I'm sure, just in terms of recruiting and vetting and finding local journalists in Gaza, how have you seen that change in the last 15 years?
No, the change was not in the last 15 years for us. It happened during the war on last war on Gaza in the last
2021.
Not 2021, 27th of October.
Okay,
that changed because Gaza was closed totally from the 7th of October. While before that, we can enter our correspondents from time to time and we can report in a different way. But when it was closed, and we didn't have any ability to send correspondents from the headquarters to be alongside our Palestinian correspondents who are there. So it's better to have both from inside and outside in order. People who are coming from Qatar, for example, to go to cover in Gaza, know the workflow more in the channel and what will make it to air or not, quality-wise and the way of structuring packages and lives. And that's a good opportunity also for training journalists who are residing in Gaza. So it's a kind of combination. But since the 7th of October, Gaza was closed. No one could get in. Some people got out. And some of our correspondents, because if you are in a war situation, you don't force anyone to work. It's something voluntarily. So some of our correspondents could find a way to leave Gaza early on. And of course, we respected that and they're out. So the number of correspondents who worked with us for a long time shrank a little. And we started to try to find other talents by also our staff who left Gaza and lived in other places, but they know local journalists in Gaza, recommended them. We have done interviews. We saw their previous work, their CVs, education, history, and then period of piloting, sampling of the work, testing the quality of the work they were sending to us or lives. All of that is off air before it comes on air. And once you are comfortable with the quality of work and the way of it, you start introducing a correspondent or a team gradually to the screen. And when you are comfortable with their work and that it doesn't carry mistakes and it's confirmed by all other sources as well, then he is a full-fledged correspondent. And I'm happy that we have few of them now, very good, well-educated, fluent in English and Arabic, know Gaza as the back of their hands, who are working there and provide us with news. I hope that I missed something.
It's actually very interesting because I mean this is the thing. No, it's very interesting. Just the follow up to that is you've mentioned you need your process of vetting them and finding them, and I think that would be very interesting for people who don't know how the news works. But obviously, it's also been a ridiculously crazy war. In terms of destruction. It's the most destruction that one has ever seen in a war in recent times. And obviously, Gaza is very small. And obviously, you know, as you've mentioned, the ethics of keeping people safe and all of those things. So just in terms of your, you know, your news desk, both yours and, I mean, you probably will know less about the Arabic channel, but you would know their processes. How do you manage all of that? I mean, just in terms of key, I remember speaking to Humna Al-Sayed on this program just after she left Gaza, and she was speaking about how she and her family were moving from, you know, building to building when there were still buildings in Gaza, and then she would have to go on air and the challenges around that. So just, you know, give our audience some insight into that, from what it's like managing it from the desk in Doha.
It's tough, it's difficult, because also you have to manage expectations of the team who is there, and you have to understand the needs of the audience to get the story and the safety and ability of your people on the ground. So our principle that governs everything is you leave in a war situation like this, you leave the risk assessment and evaluation to the team on the ground. They have the final word. It's not yours. Okay? And people here have to accept that, although they want a story on air and they want a show and they want to show that they have correspondence and coverage from the place of the events, but they have to accept that. If a correspondent say, I can't appear now, I have to see, go and see your family. Make sure that everything is right and then come back to us. There is not only one way to cover news. There are several ways and several sources. And as you mentioned, it's not only the correspondents we hire, but also social media is a good source. But that will require extra effort from us to be able to vet and make sure of the authenticity of the video or the information we are getting. So, for example, you get a video of an attack somewhere, and your correspondent is with his family because they have to do something or secure them or whatever. There could be a phone conversation to tell him that this happened. Can you, by the telephone, inquire while you are doing that? That's one thing. Yeah, but it's not only correspondents. It's also doctors, civil workers, people who are working in registry, teachers. That we know. And you can cross-check the information that comes as a source from social media. News agencies are another source. Statements of different organizations, international, local, human rights, that come from there. So it's not only about the team in Gaza. The team in Gaza is the most crucial and most important, but at the same time, they have to mind their own safety, own family, their security first, before anything else. When they are comfortable, and comfortable that nothing is targeting them, then they can come back and appear on screen. And they understand that, and we tell them that, and they are free to appear or not appear. And this is the protocol we are following. It was difficult to convince, you know, how the news editors and EPs are. They are pushy and they want everything. It was difficult to convince them at the beginning, but when the situation became clear how dangerous and deadly it is, in Gaza specifically. Now, everyone is following that and respect it.
I think many people, I mean, who've been following Al Jazeera and seeing your correspondence, seeing Hind Khodri on Al Jazeera English, and those who are seeing Anas al-Sharif and others before he was killed, I mean, you could see that as time were going on, they're losing weight. They are also, you know, just as everyone in Gaza is sort of subject to starvation and being made homeless and, you know, not having access to normal things like running water and food and sanitation, all of those things. I mean, have you ever managed a team for this long where they're subject to those conditions? And just what's that been like in terms of trying to process that, and also just psychologically for you and your editors and who are managing the team directly?
This is the first genocide I have covered. My career spans for 40 plus years. There was never a genocide. I have worked during that career on Iran-Iraq war, Sudan civil war, Lebanon civil war, call it, name it, first Gulf War, second Gulf War, but there was never anything like that. This is a genocide. It's 2 million people under siege in a very small strip who have been bombed daily for 2 years with a big number of casualties and no following of, I mean, look, international organizations are saying that this is genocide and it's war crimes, and people, high officials everywhere are indicted to be investigated for that. That never happened anywhere. I didn't cover the Bosnian civil war or what happened in Rwanda or Srebrenica, but I think it will be, even these events, Rwanda and Srebrenica, didn't last for 2 years. Yes, it was atrocious, but all the violence happened in very short time and very violently, yes, really, and it's war crimes and it deserves all condemnation everywhere, but this is systematic for 2 years, going on every day. You have to think about people who are sitting in war rooms and plan the next bombing on civilians, populations who are actually in tents in one place that they cannot move, okay, and give the order and see the result. And the result, as it is said, to destroy Hamas and protect self-defense was cited at one time. And you see that this cannot be self-defense. Hamas wasn't destroyed. And fine, you want it out. There are several ways to do that. I mean, it's not the only organization that a state wants to eliminate, but it doesn't happen this way. If you have something like KKK in the US and you want to eliminate it because it killed someone else in another country, you don't go and bomb 300 million people in the United States. It's proportionality as well. When you have 60,000 people killed in Gaza from a population of 2 million, you have to multiply by 300 in order to see what is it equivalent in the United States if it is subjected to the same violence? And you'll find that means killing maybe 30 million people. And that's not, I haven't seen anything like that. Sometimes words cannot describe it. Sometimes pictures cannot describe it. Because there is something that's completely wrong behind it. And as journalists, we shouldn't accept that. We shouldn't accept violations of human rights from either side, but more than that, we shouldn't accept genocide to be committed in front of our eyes without raising the flag and say that's happening. And this is all what we can do as journalists. And when we say that, then you become a target and you are shot at and you are being killed. That's what's happening.
Israel has killed, as I mentioned, 270 journalists. A few years back, there was an Al Jazeera journalist in an Egyptian jail, Pisa Gresta, and a lot of his colleagues and many other Al Jazeera staff, by the way, were held from the Arabic Channel in Egyptian jails. You know, when there was this campaign and a lot of journalists in the West got behind it, journalism is not a crime. When you compare the solidarity you got as an organization then to the solidarity you're getting now when your journalists and other journalists, many, are being killed, what's that been like for you?
I might be criticized for what I'm going to say, and criticized harshly, and I hope that doesn't happen, and I hope people understand what I'm saying. The case of journalists in Egypt was granted support like that for several reasons. It happened in Egypt. Israel was not a party to. And as I'm telling you, by time, culture, heritage, relations, there is an inbuilt bias towards what Israel says. And that's the difference between Gaza and what happened in Egypt. There is another factor. What happened in Egypt is that journalists from Al Jazeera English were imprisoned. And the language is important here. And among them was one Western journalist. And all of that attracted attention of all the newspapers and the channels in Europe, United States, Australia, of course. That's the main difference between the two. Although the size and the impact and the effect and the number of people who were hurt or killed or whatever, there is no comparison whatsoever. But the kind of publicity here is different than there, I think because of these two main reasons.
I mean, the industry, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but it also seems the industry has become a lot more polarized for many reasons. I mean, in the US, it became polarized when Trump came to office, you know, between the MSNBC and Fox News, for example. They were already on a polarizing move, but they even became more polarized. But this war has also been polarizing for the media. And I'm sure there's many people who are in the West now who saw Al Jazeera as, who, you know, I personally think Al Jazeera is extremely reliable and on the ground and does very good journalism. And I say that as a staff member and someone who sees the channel. And I'm sure there are other people out there. Even Hillary Clinton once mentioned Al Jazeera in during the Arab Spring. As you know, her quote was, when you see Al Jazeera, you get the sense that you're seeing real news. But October 7th has kind of split that landscape. And I think now, it's clear that many people in the West are very mistrustful of Al Jazeera. They would say, I mean, they would buy into, maybe they don't buy it, but they kind of have sympathy with Israel's argument that many of your correspondents are working for Hamas or Hamas commanders or Hamas affiliated. They kind of also, because Qatar sort of mediates with Hamas and U.S. negotiators and Israeli negotiators, which is done because the U.S. has asked them to do that, among other reasons. And so they also kind of camp you with Qatar and close to Hamas. How do you think that also plays into this narrative?
I don't think there is polarization. There are, of course, I mean, from the Israeli side, maybe American side, they try to make anyone who report properly and proper and objectively and to say that he's supporting Hamas. That has been happening, but that's not polarization. It's part of the political game that's not played in media. We are not part of it ourselves, and we don't want to take part of it, but we are sometimes a subject of it. And when it happens, we just don't pay attention to that and continue to do what we are doing, what we believe in. If you are an honest journalist, reporting really what you know and trying to get the truth out to the audience will have trust in you. So the majority of the audience, our audience, and the audience in general, trust what we are broadcasting. They, some of them, might not like it, okay? And that's understandable. And when they don't like it, they might go out and write that Al Jazeera is representing Hamas or whatever. Deep in their hearts, they know different. And that's why we continue doing what we are doing with confidence, because we don't falsify facts. We don't appear and say, for example, there is no famine in Gaza, while every international organization will tell you that there is famine in Gaza. We don't say the numbers of the people who are killed in Gaza are just few thousands, while all international and human rights organizations will tell you there are more 60,000 and 150,000 injured. We don't lie, and that lasts. While people who lie, their lie don't live for long. And as I'm telling you, people might not like what we are broadcasting, but they'll have trust and confidence in it, even if they don't express that and say otherwise.
You mentioned earlier on, you mentioned reporting from Israel, and Al Jazeera has been banned from Israel. It happened probably about 5 or 6, I can't recall exactly, you'd know better, 5 or 6 months into this war. How has that sort of impacted your reporting from Israel, and how have you tried to work your way around that?
That's something we regret, really, because we had something like 4 teams working in Israel in every aspect of life. It reported the people who were displaced in the north of Israel on the borders with Lebanon and around Gaza Strip. It reported the military buildup. We reported all the political landscape inside Israel, public opinion, feeling, everything. We didn't leave anything. And we guested a lot of Israeli voices, pro-war, anti-war, representing the army, representing the government. And that was important in order to convey our effort to report comprehensive pictures from all sides. Now, this is a trick always used by governments who don't want the full story to appear. There is an issue, for example, in a certain government, and you call them and say, okay, I want an interview with an official about that issue. and they deny you the interview. All what you can have to do, what you can do, is report the other side and represent the government by words rather than by guests. Then that government will come later and say, "See, you are biased. You interview that guy who is opposition, but you didn't interview the government. You mentioned his story completely while you put two lines here." And that's what Israel has done. It realized that for the world, when we appear from Tel Aviv, from Haifa, from Ashkelon, from the borders with Gaza, people know that we are reporting both sides. Okay, although we are subject to censorship still inside Israel, while we are not censored in Gaza. But the audience will see that you are in both sides, and they know you are reporting both sides, so you gain more confidence. Now Israel banned us, and guess what? The next thing, you are a mouthpiece of Hamas, and you are biased, which is typical, but no one is believe. People don't buy that anymore. These are very old tricks. And people understand better now. You cannot hide the facts.
You mentioned you were also subject to the censor in Israel. Just give us insights. How does the censorship work? How did it impact your work when you did report from there? And how is Al Jazeera kind of dealing with that? Because I'm sure it involves, because usually you deal with your editor and you tell the editor this is what's going on, and the editor gives you feedback. And if you're writing a file, you may go back and forth between yourself and the organization. But now there's an entire different entity that's coming in. How did that sort of impact the process, and how did it change your journalism?
Yeah, as you know, it didn't change much, but because as you know, to go and report in Israel, you have to get the press card, and I think that's from the press organization or something, which will make you under the scrutiny of military censorship. There are rules for the military censorship, and if you avoid them, no censor will come and change what you have written. That was in the first 6 months of the conflict. There wasn't much to censor or whatever inside Israel, but we were banned, and after that I don't know what the status is.
How do they actually, though, like in your experience, have you seen them kind of interfering with the work?
Because not with us. But you can see it in news agencies, for example. You'll find news lines that were deleted by the censor, or pieces that are. It happened in a subtle way. Some pieces that or packages are being edited to suit the rules of censorship. But in wars in general, we know from experience, because we covered wars, there are certain things that you don't touch in your packages. For example, close-up of military equipment, license plate numbers of military vehicles, specific locations where you are covering military movement. It's usually military that we try to avoid. I don't think there is censorship in Israel about the political points of views, but it's military censorship. The conflict in Gaza is military. So you can imagine.
So it sounds like when you want to deal with those aspects that they will censor, you get it from other reporters. You get it from reporters inside Gaza,
yes,
or inside,
yes,
Lebanon,
but,
or Jordan,
but,
or whatever.
But the point is, all the reporting we were getting, we reported from Israel about Israel. But about the military operations from Gaza, we got from Gaza. And that's not censored. But if we send people from Israel embedded with Israeli army, of course it's going to be censored, but we don't do embed.
Okay, so
because of that.
Okay, that's more clear. The offices in the West Bank have also been raided. They've been closed. Initially Al Jazeera Arabic, but obviously it's impacted Al Jazeera English's reporting as well. I'm sure your offices have also been closed down, and it works out of one bureau. How has that impacted your reporting from the West Bank? And also, just what are you seeing from your reports as you've been observing for 22 months? Just how are you seeing the situation in the West Bank sort of changing as well?
Well, let me go back to the reporting from Israel. Although we are banned from Israel, but we didn't stop guesting journalists, academics, eyewitnesses, politicians from Israel, because they are not banned. We are banned to be on the ground. So we got the Israeli point of view from this side. In the West Bank, the same thing. We can get guests, eyewitnesses from anywhere, and we rely on news agencies and local companies which are providing us with news lines and videos and sometimes details of different stories that's happening there. Although I think what we are getting now from the West Bank is maybe 1/10 of the story that's getting there. Our coverage in Gaza or from Gaza is more comprehensive. We can go to the field, we can detect the harm that's happening, while in the West Bank we rely on, as I'm telling you, private companies, news agencies, social media, and that's not enough because that's not seeing as your trained correspondents, eyes and ears, will do if they are in the West Bank. I hear about scorched land policies in some of the refugee camps in the West Bank. That's never reported properly because we don't have correspondents there. We get the pictures, we talk about it, but that's different than when you have your own correspondent telling you, here I covered 2 years ago, and that was a district that's full of houses, kids playing on the ground, and look at it now, it's nothing. That makes a difference.
Why hasn't Al Jazeera been able to do that? Why hasn't it been able to hire and train and get local people in the West Bank to do that?
It's not local people. If you hire anyone and he appears on Al Jazeera, he is going to be arrested by the Israeli occupation force because the banning in the West Bank came from the Israeli occupation force, Israeli military ruler of the West Bank or governor.
Okay, so it's simply a case of autonomy. You can do it in Gaza because it's a war zone, and in West Bank it's fully occupied, and so they would be arrested.
Yeah.
And
accepted. So in Gaza we move freely, we report freely, but in the West Bank, anyone appears on Al Jazeera will be subject to immediate arrest by Israeli army.
I want to go back to the assassination and killing of Shireen Abu Akla. Israel denied that they killed her. The matter went to court and everything else, and eventually all the evidence has come through that indeed she was killed by Israeli military. And of course, you mentioned even earlier that Al Jazeera's offices in Gaza were bombed in 2012. There's been a lot of intimidation. How has that impacted the culture of journalism in Al Jazeera toward when it comes to deploying to Israel and deploying to these places where, in the case of Israel, deploying to Israel and Gaza and the West Bank, right, where that your journalists are subject to intimidation and threat?
Are you talking about that between the assassination of Shireen Abu Akla and the 7th of October?
Yes.
After the 7th, the deployment became a little bit more difficult.
I'm talking before 7 of October, yes.
Look, the assassination of Shireen Abu Akla was a huge shock to everyone working in Al Jazeera. And it's a real cold-blooded murder. If you remember the circumstances, she was standing alone, peaceful, wearing a jacket that's written press on it, so well recognized that she is not a fighter or whatever. And she was killed by one shot by a sniper. So that was shocking. And I think it meant to shock people and make every journalist afraid. It's tragedy. She is a great journalist. I worked with her for a long, long time. There was shock and sadness, of course. But did it achieve the purpose? Does it deter people from going there? It makes us really even more resilient and insisting that we have to get the story out. But not only that. It's also that there should be accountability. We are not going to stay silent while the perpetrators go without facing the consequences of a cold-blooded murder like this. So we did everything possible in order to do that. There were investigations about it that proved she was killed by an Israeli sniper in a car, I think 200 meters away. And international organizations also made their investigations and reached the same conclusion. Unfortunately, when you complain to Israel, or when Israel says, we don't want something like ICC looking into that, the killer investigates himself and finds himself innocent, and everyone is happy except the victim. And that happened there. It didn't affect our ability to deploy people. When we deploy people to West Bank, to Gaza, to Palestine, to Ukraine, we take every precaution for their protection. But as journalists, we know that there is a certain amount of risk to go to cover in a war zone. And we accept that. It's part of our mission. It's part of our profession as well. And we volunteer to do that. When I ask someone to go to Ukraine, I don't assign someone and tell them, if you don't go, you are going to be fired. You ask them, who wants to cover Ukraine? And you'll find people who are passionate about the story and passionate to get their journalism out to the world and to add what they can add to the coverage. And the same thing happens in Gaza, West Bank, Lebanon, name it. That's what we do. That's our bread and butter. And without that, audience of the world will be in the dark, and conflicts will go on unchecked, and crimes will continue to be committed without being covered, uncovered.
You spoke earlier on about just, you know, you've never covered a genocide, and what you've been seeing has been really difficult, and I'm sure difficult for your teams, obviously on the ground and also in the newsroom. There's also, I mean, before Anas and his team were killed, Samir Abudaka was killed on the 15th of December 2023. Ahmed Alou was killed on the same day. Hamza Al-Dadou, the son of the famous Wilder Dadou, who was also injured and was evacuated from Gaza, was killed on the 7th of January 2024. Ismail Al-Ghul, 31st of July last year. Rami Al-Rifi, 31st of July as well. Hossam Shabbat, 24th of March this year. And then Anas, Muhammad Greka, Ibrahim Zahir, Muhammad Nofal, and Mu'min Aliwa were all killed on the 10th of August. What is it like when all of these, you know, incidences occurs, when all of these people were killed? Because with each one coming, you don't know what will happen next. But for example, when Samir Abudaka was killed, how did it impact your team, your teams both in Al Jazeera English and Al Jazeera Arabic? What goes through the newsroom?
It's a long list, isn't it?
Yes.
Sad thing. As I'm telling you, it's shock, grief, sadness, and it injects, as I'm telling you, more resilience to the people. We have to continue working despite the shock and sadness. And of course, it's different between people who are in Doha and people who are in the field, who are living with these guys every day, eat with them, walk with them, work with them. That's different. Of course, it's even more shocking and sad. But I can imagine that it didn't stop them, and it made them more persistent that they want to complete the mission rather than abandon it. And here in Doha, it is the same thing, because all the teams, we deal with them, not every one of us, but the people on the news desk, on daily basis. We know them, we know their lives, we know now their families, their problems, their issues. It's that kind of bond. But as I'm telling you, when we never want anything like that happen. But when it happens, well, it has its impact, but it doesn't stop people from carrying on the mission and continuing the noble work they started.
All of these killings and murders and the killings of all the journalists who also work for all other organizations has obviously been unacceptable, completely horrific. There's something, though, about this last killing where Anas al-Sharif and his five colleagues were all killed at the same time outside of hospital. I guess it's also got to do with the fact that, you know, more because of the sustained coverage from Al Jazeera and others, that people are now seeing what exactly is happening in Gaza. And it's the first time I've seen in international media there's been more accountability against Israel than normal, you know, with all the other killings. Specifically this particular, do you remember where you were? Were you on the newsroom floor? It wasn't, because it was late at night, but do you remember what it was like the next morning or when you heard the news? Just can you walk us through what happens on that day at Al Jazeera head office when, you know, colleagues wake up or they may be following at night and they hear that their colleagues have only been killed?
I was at home when it happened. And if you know the city, Qatari capital Doha, it's short distance from my home to the channel. So I trust the newsroom. They started doing the proper coverage of what's happening. And I came to the newsroom myself, maybe half an hour later or something. We had rolling news going on air for the rest of the night and the second day. And people were, of course, shocked, sad. But at the same time, they wanted all sides of the story to be there. And to get information about the people who sacrificed their life for covering the news in an objective and fair way, and the other side wanted to silence them. So you can understand that there was people didn't feel tired, although they worked long hours overnight until the second day, because they wanted to do that. They wanted to have the story out to the world. It's not easy. What can I say? That's what we do. When you are encountered with something like this, you put more effort in order to complete the mission.
Again, I mean, you're the wrong person to ask. I should be asking your correspondents who are in Gaza. But those, like Hind, for example, needed to report on the death of her colleagues. And in Al Jazeera Arabic, the same thing is going on. What's that sort of, you know, management like between your desk and the correspondents who are now seeing themselves reporting on their colleagues who used to help them file their work literally just, you know, a half a day before?
Well, I'll tell you from our side here, the first thing we thought of when that happened is we don't want any correspondent to be in a position of danger, to be spotted or whatever. So that's different than Arabic, because our correspondents were not at the vicinity, I think, at that time, the English correspondents. Arabic correspondents were nearby. But then everyone started participating very, very quickly in that. As I'm telling you, there are people, our correspondents and the Arabic, the whole Al Jazeera, we are one team, in fact, if you think about it. Different shifts, different channels, but it's the same team working in the same place. The same thing as I'm telling you about, it's they worked with them day and night. They know them personally. Some of them maybe have been in studying with them or know them as it's a small community there, maybe the families. I don't have the details, knew each other, but it was an atmosphere of sadness and grief and shock. But they had to come and talk about the deceased colleagues, how they were like, what is the importance of their work, plus their own work as well. For us, we were thinking about the story and the security at the same time, and we had to redraw our protocols of working on the ground a little bit.
You mentioned this has been the first genocide you've covered. It's also been, by many estimates, the most brutal attack on journalists. What do you think this genocide and its attack on journalism, how does it impact the future of journalism in conflict zones? And how important do you think, I mean, obviously it's of immense importance, but just how do you quantify the importance of the work that Al Jazeera has been doing in the last 22 months in Gaza?
How it's going to impact the journalism? I hope it impacts the international politics, not journalism. I hope that our journalistic work and covering the story relentlessly this way will participate in creating a real effective international mechanism or organization that should prevent that from happening. We have to revive the slogan, which actually Israel or the Jewish community rightly adapted after World War II, which is never again, and which Israel is working against it 100%, violating it totally. We have to say never again. We have to say that, not to Jewish people, not to Arab people, not to any people in the world. That should never happen. that genocide revealed that there is no international mechanism that can prevent it. And that slogan, after the Holocaust in World War II, never again, is violated by the same government that claims it represents the people who suffered that. And actually it does disservice to the memory of the Holocaust by committing the same crimes again. So that's what I hope for. It's not about the profession of journalism. I hope that our journalism will trigger a new mechanism to make the slogan never again really effective again for everyone in the world.
Salah, thanks for your time. Just the last question before you actually go. When this started on the 7th of October, you've obviously covered many conflicts in Gaza, many, you know, retaliatory attacks that Israel does on Gaza. I guess we all knew that this would be quite bloody. But did you ever imagine that we'd still be talking about this 22 months later, and it would become as gruesome and as bloody and as cruel as it has been?
No, because it started like an attack against Israel and retaliation against this attack and self-defense. And I think all these purposes stopped maybe after 2 months and a lot of bombing. So what to retaliate against if you kill 10,000 people and destroy half of Gaza? And how come it's continuous self-defense if you continue attacking almost defenseless people, claiming that you want to eradicate a group that you don't like? So no one imagined that. I thought it's going to finish in a few weeks' time. And yes, with weakening any group or whatever, because Israel has got a huge army, and of course it's going to make an impact. But to continue like this, continuously, I described to you, imagine you wake up every day and look at the map of Gaza, which nothing is left of it except few dots that concentration of people are living in, and you say, okay, I'll bomb there, and you choose a point, and you know that who are going to die there are maybe 1,000 civilians and one Hamas operative, and you say that's proportionate.
Salah Najm, thank you so much for your time. I'm sure the work definitely the work you've done is been really, you know, appreciated by the world under very unfortunate circumstances. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to, you know, someone in the leadership of Al Jazeera, you know, and sort of drawing back the curtain so that the world can understand a little bit about what you go through in your world as you bring us the news every single day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Unapologetic is a show that unapologetically looks at the life, times, and views of some unapologetic and not so unapologetic humans, hosted by me, Ashfaq Karim. We hope this week's episode enabled you to learn something. Subscribe to stay connected with us. Your support means we can continue bringing you more of these stories. Until next time, goodbye.